Oh, warm welcome. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to those of you who tiptoed into the Zoom room or the actual room while we were having our settling meditation. And as most of you probably know, this is the first day in a 4-day series, 5-day series on the Four Noble Truths. We'll be doing it monthly. And time now for some brief introductions. Most of you know I'm Dawn Neal. I'm the newish guiding teacher of Insight Santa Cruz. And I'm delighted to be here with my friend and colleague, Tenzin Choki. You can say any more about yourself that you want or not.
Yeah, so I'm Tenzin and also new-ish teacher here at Insight Santa Cruz and love this topic and looking forward to our time together.
I'm going to start with introductions.
Yeah, so what we thought we'd do for this series, we've got 5 sessions, the second Saturday of each month through May. We know maybe not everybody can stay for the whole 5 sessions, and that's also fine. We're not taking registration or requiring full attendance. But one of the things that we have designed into this teaching, some of our courses are either just the teacher's teaching or lots of silent practice, but we're going to be exploring for this series a little bit more interactively and have time for discussion in small groups and discussion as a bigger group of some of the topics. It's easy to hear these things and almost approach them like a college student, just like you're learning a bunch of facts that don't have anything to do with your life, but we're really not approaching it in that way. We're really trying to make it relatable. So we'll have a lot of discussion group prompts about how the material relates to your own life, how it shows up in your life that hopefully will enable you to take the learnings away in a way that's really meaningful and transformative for you. And to that end, we'd like to begin by just finding out who everyone is in the space. And we've thought a nice way to do that would be to put you into pairs, have you introduce yourself to someone that you don't know. We're going to set up Zoom breakout rooms, so we're not really sure how many people don't know each other in the Zoom room, but in the physical room, choosing a partner that you don't know yet. And we'll have about 6 minutes, about 3 minutes each, to just introduce yourself to your partner. You might, I mean, obvious things like their name, maybe anything about their background in Buddhism or meditation, if that's relevant, or another spiritual path. And then when we come back to the bigger room, we'll have an opportunity for everyone to introduce their new friend. So we'll take a little bit longer for this in the first session, just as we're getting to know each other, but we're hoping it'll create more of a sense of relationality and community and intimacy in our group. In Buddhism, and we'll get to this, we talk about the three jewels of refuge: Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, or spiritual community. And those of you that know me know that this is sort of a thing of mine. I sometimes think our spiritual community refuge is a little shortchanged in our kind of modern individualistic life. So we're going to provide some opportunities to kind of connect with one another. So what we'll do, we'll open up the Zoom rooms. We'll have 6 minutes and then give you a minute to just grab, so if there's somebody next to you don't know, you can just pair up with someone and just 6 minutes, and then we'll ring a bell just to interview briefly for about 3 minutes your new friend, and then you have a chance to introduce them. You can also take notes if that will help you remember their name, for example. So pick a partner, and we'll see you in 6 minutes. chieftain of the small tribal republic, but sometimes we call his father the king and say that he was a prince. And so he grew up when he was born, actually, which was the custom in India, especially back then, and even now, astrologers were consulted to see what his destiny would be, right? Astrology still is a big deal in India, and marriages are arranged due to the astrology and so forth. And so this wise sage predicted that the future Buddha, Gautama, would either become a great king ruling over many lands or a great sage showing the path to freedom and liberation from suffering. And so his father, this king, was pretty interested in the first outcome. He wasn't so psyched at the idea. And you can imagine, you know, some very powerful man, would he want his son to become the president of the United States or a cloistered monk off in a monastery? You can imagine, right? So no different there. And he wasn't stupid, King Suddhodana. And he said, oh, if I shield him from any possibility of seeing suffering, that's probably the best way to guarantee that he goes on this trajectory that I'm pretty invested in, becoming this powerful king. And so he famously built three palaces, one for the hot season, one for the wet season, and one for the cold season, filled with sensual pleasures, right? And didn't even allow the young prince to go outside of the palace gates unless they first cleaned up the streets. Nobody old, nobody sick, nobody ugly allowed, you know, just beautiful young people on the streets whenever he would go out, which was rare. So, as you can imagine, this worked out for a while, right? All this comfort and all this pleasure, but nothing but pleasure. I don't know if you guys have noticed, we'll talk about this. It gets a little boring when everything's just too easy. And so the prince became a little curious. He was a bit of a late bloomer. This happened when he was about 29. I was the one sneaking out in the middle of the night when I was like 14 or 15. But anyway, that's another story. So he got his friend, who is his charioteer, to sneak him out of the palace gates, right? He's like, what's really going on out there? I get the feeling that, you know, this idea of like perfection. And so his friend snuck him out of the palace gates, and he famously saw for the first time a sick person, an old person, and a corpse. And you'll see in India, the funerals, I used to lead pilgrimages of the Buddhist holy places in India, and often, you know, the bus would have to pull over because there'd be a funeral procession, and it was just the body on a litter, sometimes the hands or legs lying down, and then they'd be cremated right there, you know, so there isn't this thing of the casket and the satin and the thing. So he saw for the first time, you know, and he was mystified, and he asked his friend Chana, the charioteer, what's wrong with that guy when he saw somebody bent over with white hair walking with a cane? And Chana said, that's old age. You know, if we're lucky enough to live that long. So he never even experienced this. So every time he went back to the palace, he starts thinking more and more. And then this sort of wish to kind of delve into the reasons for this suffering that he'd seen really woke up in him. Of course, his father did not give permission. Oh, by the way, the fourth vision that he saw, the fourth time he went out of the palace gates with Chana, was a mendicant, a monastic, walking through the busy, crowded, crazy marketplace with a begging bowl, shaved head, and robes, with this kind of aura of incredible peace and serenity. And so he said to Chana, who's that? And Chana said, that's a renunciate. That's someone who's given up the householder's life to seek, you know, the meaning of life and the truth. And so so that inspired the future Buddha. So he tried to get permission from his father to leave. Dad says, no way, you're going to become a king. That's that. Don't even ask me anymore. So he got Chana to sneak him out of the palace. He left in the middle of the night. It's really moving, actually, to go to this place in southern Nepal where he left. You can stand right at the gate where he left to go off to seek his spiritual fortune. And then for many years spent studying with different teachers, attaining the highest level of realization that those teachers taught of meditative quiescence, of these rarefied states of concentration and practice, but felt like it's not really it. Like any other high, when I come down, when I come out of meditation, I'm still suffering. I'm still dissatisfied. There's still this like itch that I can't scratch. It's not ultimate freedom from dissatisfaction, which I'm looking for. And so he left his teachers and then went off with five of his friends and said, okay, we're just going to go off into the forest and meditate until we kind of break through and figure out what's the nature of reality, what's the cause of this suffering. And so they did extreme ascetic practices for about 6 years. And there's these famous statues that you can see, the future Buddha right before his enlightenment. And you might have seen some of these famous statues, and he looks just like a skeleton covered in skin. And they say when he poked his stomach, he could feel his backbone. I've never had that experience, as you can imagine. Can't even imagine it. And was living off like 2 grains of brown rice and 5 lentils a day, basically. And then he realized, as many of us do too, when you denigrate your body to that extent, when, there was this idea that I overcome the needs of my body, my spirit will somehow be free. But he realized, and I realized this anytime I just skipped lunch, you get kind of dizzy and spacey. So he couldn't meditate well, right? Because his body, of course, supported his mind. So he couldn't meditate well. And then there was a famous story that a young woman had been praying to a forest deity for a healthy birth. And she'd just given birth. And so she was bringing this beautiful offering of rice milk. And I think it's like that kheer that you get in Indian restaurants at the end. It's all cardamom and yummy milk and rice. So she's bringing an offering and she sees the Buddha sitting under a tree, skeleton covered in skin, doesn't even look human. She thinks he's this deity that she's been praying to and offers him the rice milk porridge and he eats it, right? And he revives his energy. His strength comes back. Meanwhile, his five friends see him and they're like, he's wimped out. He's given up the path. We're going to diss him. And they leave after seeing him eat this rice milk porridge. And then the way the story goes, with his strength revived, he sits under this famous tree, the Bodhi tree, that a descendant is still there in Bodh Gaya, and says, I'm not getting up until I've broken through. And then that night, meditates all night, achieves full enlightenment, just as the sun is coming up in the morning. And then the way the story goes, he didn't think anyone else was going to be able to realize what he had realized. And so for 49 days, he didn't teach. And he was just thinking, that's it. I'll just stay in the forest and meditate for the rest of my life. My realization was so profound. Nobody's going to be able to get this. And if you go to Bodh Gaya now, there are these 7 sort of pillars showing where he was during each week of those 49 days. And my favorite one, there's a pillar that says, for 7 days, he stared at the Bodhi tree with an unblinking gaze. And you could just imagine him going, whoa, that was far out. Wow. Just like mind blown. And then the way the story goes, these Hindu deities descended and said to him, please, please teach. There are some beings with just a little dust in their eyes. I love that, right? Just a little dust in their eyes. And so he started thinking about who might have just a little dust in their eyes. And he thought of his 2 prior spiritual teachers, but he started asking around and they had just passed away. And then he thought of his 5 friends. And so he found out where they had gone and went to them. They saw him coming, and it was interesting. The story goes, they saw him coming, and they're like, let's ignore him. The slacker. He gave up. We're just going to, But he's coming, and he has this sort of glow of this aura and this vibe. And so they didn't even, like, plan it, but they just put out a robe for him to sit and watered and washed his feet. And he sat down, and they're like, so what happened to you? Right? And then he gave the first teaching on the Four Noble Truths. It's the Sutra of the turning the Dharma wheel. And this is sort of a metaphor for getting things going again after a period. There are these sort of ages in Buddhism. And so we taught the Four Noble Truths. And so in that first teaching, sure enough, there were of his five disciples, just a little bit of dust in their eyes, and one gained realization just on the basis of that first teaching that the Buddha gave. And then for 45 years after that, he traveled around teaching, established the community of followers that grew and grew, both the monastic community of both men and women, and many, many lay disciples. And so we're lucky enough to get those teachings passed down to us. So that's the story of the Buddha's life. I led many pilgrimages to all these places. So moving. It's very interesting. Until in the West, until the late 1800s, the anthropologists thought that the Buddha was just a mythical figure like Lord Krishna or Zeus or something like that, and only realized it was a real person when they started doing archaeology. Buddhism had kind of disappeared for the most part from India. Nobody knew where these holy places were. It's kind of, for me, one of the only advantages of colonialism is the British actually found the holy places of Buddhism when they were invaded India and kind of took over and discovered and actually realized, oh, this is a real person who lived that we're talking about here. So one way of looking at the story is, yes, these are actual facts of what happened in the Buddha's life. I think there's another way of looking at it that I find kind of more interesting personally is more of a metaphor of our own spiritual search, right? So many of us probably in this room grew up comfortable, right? Mostly we probably, I'm just assuming, but it's a pretty good guess, we probably had enough to eat, comfortable circumstances, might have had caregivers like the Buddha's parents that tried to protect him from seeing suffering. I grew up in suburbia, the most boring, protected place you can imagine, these terrible suburbs of these major cities, you know, so kind of protected. And then we have some kind of wake-up call. We see some suffering, right? Maybe somebody close to us dies. Maybe our heart gets broken really badly, right? So similar to what happened with the Buddha when he kind of goes out of the comfort zone, something happens. It happens eventually to all of us, right? And sometimes for us, that's the wake-up call, is something like that that we experience. And then we start our search. And maybe like the Buddha, we have a couple of dead ends. We try a little bit of this, we try a little bit of that. I grew up in, like, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, so much to try. And I tried it all, right? Try a little bit of this and yoga and Tai Chi and this kind of meditation and that. And now they have new things to try, like Wim Hof ice baths. You know, I didn't have that. I don't have to do that. All kinds of things. And then you find, like the Buddha did, a path that just feels like it suits you. And then you follow the path, hopefully also with these beautiful companionship of others. And so one thing that I think is interesting to look at, and one of the prompts you'll have when we put you into small groups, is, does this metaphor kind of work? Can you find stages of your own life that sort of correlate to these stages of the Buddha's life? So is it historical fact or not? Does it really matter? Because I think for us, it really serves as sort of a metaphor of the spiritual path and trying these different things. And so the famous kind of framing of the Four Noble Truths that we're going to be talking about and unpacking, and just to introduce this piece before we go into small groups, the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. So we're also going to be starting to discuss today, starts with the first noble truth, right? And so Buddha gets a bad rap. Oh, the Buddha only talked about suffering. And the Buddha said life is suffering. By the way, the Buddha never said life is suffering. That's a complete mistranslation or misinterpretation. But the Buddha said life is subject to unsatisfactory experiences. That's the first noble truth. We all are subject until we're free, until we're liberated, We're all subject to, from time to time, not that every moment of life is suffering, because I think when the first noble truth gets framed as life is suffering, there's two dangers. One is people dismiss it altogether. Oh, the Buddha was a trauma survivor. His mother died the first week of his life. Just he's damaged, you know, he thinks life is suffering. Or we suspect our own moments of happiness. We'll have a moment of happiness that comes from connection or meaning, right? Or present moment awareness. And we'll go, oh, that felt really, oh, no, that couldn't have felt good because the Buddha said life is suffering. No, of course there are these moments, but we're talking about lasting, permanent, sustained happiness or well-being might be even a better kind of way of framing it. And suffering is also kind of an extreme translation of this word. Just to go into the etymology for a second, dukkha is the word that's usually translated as suffering, and it has an interesting etymology. It's a compound of two different words, du and akka. And one of the meanings of akka is a hole. For example, the hole in a wheel that the axle goes through. Think of the time of Lord Buddha, ox carts. Even now in India, when I lead pilgrimages, the bus is always having to pass an ox cart laden with sugar cane, you know, or something like that. So du means something like out of kilter. So think of an out of kilter wheel, right, on an ox cart or on the grocery trolley at New Leaf, right? And you're trying to push it, you're just aiming for the organic broccoli and it keeps slamming up against the sun chips or something. And you're like, no, I'm not after, so I want the thing. That's what the Buddha was, that's the first noble truth. If, by the way, we even know we're after the organic broccoli, which we may not even have any idea. How often do you wander around, especially sap of life, because there's so much, you're just like, wow, amazing. So sometimes we don't even know what we want out of life. And then we even know what we want, and we just can't quite steer. Anybody relate to that? Right? Have we all had the out of kilter grocery cart experience? So that's the first one, because sometimes it's easy for us to dismiss suffering and go, oh, suffering. No, come on. I live in Santa Cruz, dude. I'm fine, right? But how much have we not been able quite to get what we want, you know? And there's many ways that the Buddha talked about suffering. We'll talk more about it. And just the final thing before we break up into small groups, one list that the Buddha talked about is the three sufferings. So he said the suffering of suffering, dukkha dukkha, and that really is the heart attacks, the bitter divorces, the car accidents, right? That's the thing that usually when we think of the word suffering, that's the kind of thing we think about. And then there's one that's more subtle yet called the suffering of change. And this is a tricky one because this one says, what we usually call pleasure is just relief from more suffering. But if we keep doing that thing, that's going to turn into suffering. So there's nothing that's pleasant in and of itself by its own nature. And I would say, you know, usually when there's a lot of women, we can understand this example of like, you know, you're going through menopause, right? So you have your hot flashes in the middle of the night. So you go to bed and you get all curled up under your nice warm comforter. And then 2 hours later, you're flinging it off. And then you get too cold. And then you put it on again. And then it becomes too hot. And you fling it off again. So anything that we call pleasure, eating too. We've just had all these holidays that we gained like 5 pounds, you know. Thanksgiving, Christmas, delicious food. One plate's amazing. Maybe even a second plate is okay. The third plate's probably going to turn into suffering. And definitely the third piece of pumpkin pie fully is going to turn into suffering. So this one is saying there is nothing that is pleasure from its own side, by its own nature. It will turn into suffering if we indulge too much. And then the third subtlest level of these three levels of suffering is called the suffering of conditioned existence. And this sort of relates to the second noble truth. As long as we're still subject to delusions and karma, it's a setup. Sooner or later, Even if we live the perfect happy life in Santa Cruz, the poop's going to hit the fan sooner or later, right? We're still not free of the conditions that can lead to suffering when they all come together. And that's the third level. So it may not be a subjective experience in that moment of unpleasantness, but it's looming. It's there, right? The causes are just there. They just haven't ripened into an experience yet. So what we want to do, did you want to add anything before we give the breakout room instructions?
Just briefly, can you hear me okay?
All right.
That you can't hear me.
Not very well.
Yes, Jesus is not working.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Let me get you another one.
Okay. I moved to the.
Could you grab one of the mics from the
person? Yeah, I think it's okay.
Yeah, so is this better now?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just trying to balance it being close enough without my lips hitting
is
the
it
mic.
Still, is it working? No. It's not working. Yeah, Manny, would you mind grabbing one?
So to underscore that the breakout rooms are around you unpacking your own experience, your own journey in light of perhaps the Buddha's journey and perhaps these three kinds of suffering. And there are subtle differences between Tenzin's tradition and the Theravada tradition about how that second kind is described, the suffering of change. So I just want to highlight that the way she presented it may be different than you've heard it before. And that the traditions have evolved. So there's goodness and beauty in the description that she gave, and there's also wisdom in what I'm about to say, which is in the earliest teachings, the Buddha didn't deny that there was real pleasure in moments and real joy in moments, but that the suffering of change, anicca dukkha, is that that will always go away. Sooner or later, whether we want it to or not, it will fade. So it's not to deny that there may be moments of joy, transcendence, pleasure, and that the suffering of change is embedded in the fact of change itself. Ajahn Chah, very famous Thai forest tradition teacher, used to say, suffering is rope burn. In other words, it's clinging on, hanging on when things are moving through, whether we want them to or not. So again, the pain of pain, suffering of suffering, the heart attack, the suffering of change, and that it's never quite right, pervasive suffering. We're going to ask you to talk about today.
And so what we're going to do now for about 15 minutes, we're going to be in groups of three to discuss. And the prompts for discussion are kind of two questions that relate to what we've been talking about so far. One is, how does this story of the Buddha's life kind of relate to your own spiritual search? Can you relate to it as a metaphor or an analogous stages to your own spiritual life and sharing that with your friends a little bit? And then the second part will be, just does this idea of the Four Noble Truths make sense to you also? You know, especially this more sort of subtle definition of suffering, because we may never have heard the subtlety. Some translators translate more as dissatisfaction, which I kind of like, right? Because it's just that sense of, and remember the out of kilter wheel business. So just a couple of guidelines for our groups. What we'd like, in fact, for the whole session, not just for the small groups, know or that you haven't talked to yet, just so we get to know each other a little bit better. Thank you.
You want to pause the recording?
I
forgot.
Just invite you to notice what it's like in your body. You have shared and have heard. Feeling in to your heart, what it's like to have been listened to in your own story and your own experience. The heart's response to hearing others' experience. And any energy shifts in your body and your breathing. And as you sit, what feels most salient, alive? What aligns most in what has been talked about today? Allowing all of that to settle. And tuning in again. To the simplicity of the breath. The body. The senses. And then in this short meditation, the invitation is to tune into your own heart's request for happiness, well-being. To invite that in. If it's helpful, to use some of the classic phrasing from the ancient tradition. May I be safe from inner and outer harm. May I be happy. Healthy, peaceful, and free. Repeating maybe a single word from these phrases or your own words. Dropping that wish in like a pebble into a well or a pond. Letting it ripple. Ripple through your body, your heart, your mind. And then expanding that wish to anyone you've spoken with today, or anyone in this community practicing here together. You'd see. Happy. Peaceful and free. Thank you. So Tenzin introduced us to the Buddha's journey and the types of suffering and the Four Noble Truths. And I'm going to say just a few words here about the universal nature of that suffering. As Tenzin said, the Buddha never said life is suffering. However, he did say that suffering is a universal quality that we all experience from time to time and in differing degrees and from different conditions. And in this sense, the medicine of the First Noble Truth is kind of in the truth itself. The Buddha was often likened to being a doctor. The diagnosis of the Four Noble Truths had within it the medicine of the path, medicine that heals, transforms, frees. But there's a little bit of the medicine in each of the Noble Truths, or ennobling truths, as they're sometimes called. And the universal nature of this suffering, part of it is that while each of us experiences difficulty, that wheel out of truth, that ka-chunk, dukkha is an automatopoeia, actually, right? All of us experience it some of the time. All sentient beings do. And that's universal, and in a way it weaves us together. The richest person on the planet experiences suffering. The poorest person experiences it. It may differ in degree. It will definitely differ in details. But the fact of it is, like, it's common to all of us, one way or another. The person you like the least experiences suffering, and the person you love the most. And I say this because some of us, I know I did early in my practice, I thought that I would be the exception to the rule, that I knew I was suffering, but somehow my suffering didn't count. It wasn't big enough. It wasn't bad enough. Guess what? It counts. Even if it's minor, even if you think it's minor, even if you haven't let it in, it counts. Others of us maybe like to assume that certain other people don't experience suffering because their lives look so good. Maybe they're beautiful, or they seem incredibly successful or wealthy or popular. Let me tell you, as a chaplain and as someone who's been around the Buddhist scene for a long time, I have seen firsthand from conversations, either being present for them or in them, that some of the wealthiest heirs or heiresses to great fortunes, beautiful, physically gorgeous people, can have some of the most acute mental and emotional suffering I've ever seen. There is no exception. Not permanently, not always. A famous teacher, a Thai Buddhist tradition teacher, Ajahn Mun, is quoted as saying, "People are all alike. But then if you look a little deeper, you see that they really aren't. And then if you look even deeper, you see that they actually are. All of the particulars differ. The stories differ. And there's a thematic kind of commonality to all of us. The dukkha-dukkha that we have in common, that first kind of suffering Tenzin talked about, is completely universal. Aging, old age, sickness, and death. There's other versions of it listed in the ancient suttas as well. Separation from the beloved. being unified with what you don't like. We've all experienced that sometimes, right? Shifts in status, usually associated with going down, loss of status, or not ever having it to begin with. Those are forms of suffering that almost every human being experiences some version of at some point in their lives. There's a story in the ancient discourses, I don't know if this made it to the Mahayana or Vajrayana canon or not, of Kisika Tomi, a woman in ancient India. And her husband had been trying for a child for years, and a child never came. And finally, this is ancient India, they conceived of and she bore birth to a beautiful baby boy. And boys were a big deal in ancient India. It was important. And that child, she cared for him and she loved him and she really looked after and nurtured him, but for no really good reason that she or her husband could identify, as a toddler, he sickened and died. And she was just bereft. Something in her snapped. And around her village, she went carrying her toddler in her arms, asking anyone who had listened to please make him better. She wouldn't accept that he had died. He's sick. Please make him better. Please make him better. And it was just heartbreaking. And the Buddha happened to be coming through, traveling as he did for those 45 years of teaching. He had a long life. And one of the villagers pointed her towards the Buddha, saying, maybe he can help you. And this heartbroken mother came up to the Buddha and asked him, please heal my son. And the Buddha immediately could see that there was no healing this young boy. So he said, here's what you need to do. Go around to every household in this village, and I want you to bring me a mustard seed from a household that has never known death. That will be your medicine. And so she did. She went from every house, every door, every household asking for a mustard seed. Has your house experienced death? Has your house been free of death? And what she got, she didn't get a single mustard seed. She got the stories of her neighbors, of her friends, of the other villagers, and realized through walking from house to house that there was no one there who hadn't experienced death in one way or another. And then she came back to the Buddha with a different understanding and was able to align herself with the tragedy of what had happened and was able to begin healing. I tell this story, it's stark, and Kisika Tomi, this mother, later ordained and became fully awakened through being able to align with the suffering of how, of what actually happened, of not trying to fight it, change it, resist it. But the story also reveals another level of these teachings of the First Noble Truth, and that is that there are certain forms of suffering that are endemic in human experience, that exist in human experience no matter what. We all grow old. If we're lucky, we grow old. We all sicken at times. Hopefully we get better, and all of us eventually are going to die. And the Buddha himself, who became fully awakened in that mind-blowing experience, He had a bad back. He got sick on occasion. He had his cousin give Dharma talks when he wasn't feeling well. And eventually he passed away. So the kind of suffering that we're being promised a release from in this path is not suffering from the bare facts of human existence. Instead, it's a true end to suffering about them. In other words, not feeling the pain, the resistance, not making things worse. The Buddha found his way to the end of suffering, not by becoming immortal, but by shifting completely how he related to what's happening. There's the what's happening, and there's the how you relate to it. And the Buddha no longer experienced the suffering of how he related to his life. And he found a very deep truth in how we can shift our relationship and begin not making things worse. There's a famous teaching there of the second arrow, that if a person is hit with an arrow, it hurts. Everything we add on top is a second arrow, a third arrow, a tenth arrow, a twelfth arrow. And so there's a way of relating to life itself, to the bad stuff that does happen, that's endemic in every life, without adding extra, without adding mental pain to the physical pain. When the heart really begins to grasp that everyone, every sentient being experiences difficulty, suffering, and that that wish to be free of the suffering is also universal, something really powerful happens. That sense of separateness falls away. Oh, I'm not alone in this. You're not alone in this. None of us are. We all experience this. And this begins to get to the kind of healing, the kind of compassion that dissolves what Einstein called the optical delusion of separateness, right? The delusion of separation. And that dissolving of the separateness that this grieving mother experienced with attempting to bring a mustard seed to the Buddha begins to create a cohesion, a meaning, a purpose in what suffering does arise, and a different way of relating to it. Instead, a tenderness can arise that these three kinds of suffering, the pain of pain, the pain of change, and the all-pervasive dissatisfaction, all of us at one time or another have that. And gosh, maybe the person who's acting like a jerk is actually hurting. Maybe I can connect in a different way to their experience, to my experience of them. So we'll talk later in this course about kind of the good news of the Buddha's teachings around all of this. But right now, just to say briefly, because these forms of suffering universally happen to humans, to people, and many of them to sentient beings, all kinds, so too are the practices that lead to the end of suffering universal. These practices work across millennia, across cultures, across genders. So, meanwhile, in this class today, this first noble truth of suffering has a specific instruction, which is to be known, to be known. And that's what we're unpacking and exploring today. How is suffering known? So again, the Buddha is often likened to a doctor, and the Four Noble Truths, the diagnosis. So I just want to encourage you, as we do this exploration for this next little while, to notice any relief in naming what is, as you explore the kinds of suffering that you've experienced in your life. And that sharing it with others can be a balm. It can be a source of connection, of healing. And if your heart breaks, let it break open. Open to yourself and open to those around you. Because there's a tremendous gift then to allow the compassion to flow in and out. And that in itself is healing. So that's my little wrap about the universal nature of suffering. And we're going to ask you now to go into breakout groups again. But before we do that, I just want to check in. Do you guys need another bio break? We are gradually welcoming back the Zoom room as well. So as everyone is popping back in, maybe we'll start this time with the main room. We don't have time for everyone to share, but we have time for a few comments. Is there anyone who's here in 3D that would like to share what that was like for you in terms of what you noticed about... Thank you, Mitchell, for starting us.
There's a button halfway up that you push. Is that on? The green light?
So it was, first of all, it was very powerful to share something that felt so personal and, you know, that's big dukkha in one's life, sharing both receiving and sharing with people that were relative strangers before and don't feel like strangers anymore because of that share. And it was also interesting. I had a hard time determining which category it went into, and it was through the process, and we all have a little of this in our three, which category of suffering we were talking about. So it was just helpful to see the bones of it, the structure of how that comes together, just for our own clarity.
Beautiful, Mitchell. Thank you. I really appreciate what you're saying, both in terms of the group wisdom, the growing clarity, and in terms of the power of sharing, of that not being alone in it. I'm going to shift to the Zoom room now. Jordan, you have your hand up. Hi.
Hello. The thing I was thinking about was when I heard the question, I was thinking about the first and the third suffering. And what I realized is how the two are actually pretty connected for me, and maybe the second to the third as well. But specifically how it's playing out right now is that I had pretty hard 5 years of just hard thing after hard thing after hard thing after hard thing. And at first I wasn't having so much of the dukkha of unsatisfactoriness. I was like, okay, this is happening. Okay, this is happening. At a certain point I was like, screw this, this is happening. I hate this, cannot stop. Why are so many bad things happening? Hard things, painful things. And then that started to spin out and snowball, right? Of like, this is unfair. Why is this happening to me? And then that trickled down, and I was thinking about it today in the sit of just the amount of times I'm like, oh, you know, can this person speak differently? Or, oh, that's too loud. You know, all the different little unsatisfactory things, I think, in a way, trickled down from the painful experiences that I wasn't able to fully be with.
Thank you. Thank you. And that insight, too, I really appreciate what you just brought up in that. If our minds are already thoroughly in that place of the why is this happening to me, or the dissatisfactoriness and the kind of resistance to the suffering, that then any little thing can poke us and become an irritation or a dissatisfaction. Whereas if our mind is in a different place, it might be, it's all good, it's fine, it can roll through. So yeah, very good. Thank you. So I think maybe that's as much as we have time for now. Thank you both very much for what you shared. And Tenzin is going to lead us in another meditation.
Yeah. So just to kind of let you know, for the time that we have left, we're going to have another practice now, another short talk, another time for meeting in small groups again. That's kind of going to be our cycle throughout this teaching, is those kind of components that we just keep cycling through. But I wanted to guide you through meditation, where we're going to get in touch again at another level. Dawn talked about the universality of suffering and just the universality of our human experience, that all of our human experience, this is a practice that shows up in many spaces. And for me, I use it a lot as a way myself and with groups to reconnect to this idea of our shared common humanity, that we're all kind of sharing this experience. It's so easy, I think, especially sometimes when we're going through distressing times, to feel like we're all alone. Nobody else is sharing our experience, but basically never true. So we're going to connect with that in this practice. So I'll invite you to just get into a comfortable posture with your back straight and your shoulders even. A lot of us are sitting up in chairs. Some people at home might be sitting down in a cushion on the floor, but just getting a nice stable posture with your back straight. And you can have your hands either resting in your lap or in the traditional posture with your thumbs touching right below your navel. You have your tongue right on the roof of your mouth, right behind your teeth. It keeps you from having to swallow constantly. And you can have your eyes either closed or in a downcast gaze with a little bit of light coming through, especially helpful if you tend to get sleepy during meditation. And then after settling into your posture, just taking a moment to feel into your body. If we've been sitting for a while, we might notice a bit of tension or tightness creeping in, and just deliberately relaxing, maybe moving your attention through your body, making sure that you're relaxed. I invite you to let go of any tension with the out-breath, settling more deeply into our posture of both alertness and relaxation. And then just turning your attention to the sensations of the breath for just a moment as a way to settle your mind, get yourself even more deeply here in your body, in the present moment. And so now I'll invite you to bring to mind a loved one or a dear friend, someone for whom you naturally feel a sense of closeness and connection. Maybe this is somebody that you share a lot of experiences in common. You feel like they really get you, they understand you, and just feel that warmth and closeness. I'll invite you to bring a specific person to mind, not just the generic category of friend, but a specific person. And you can imagine them seated in front of you, facing you. If it's easy to get a visual image, imagining them in the space in front of you, or if it's hard to get a clear visual image, just try and invoke a felt sense of that person's presence as if they were really here with you in this room. And just taking a few moments to really make their presence real. And as this person's presence becomes real, or the visual image, along with that felt sense, really having the recognition that this person, this real person that you know and care for in your life, is a fellow human being, just like you. Think to yourself, this person has a body and a mind just like me. This person has sensations and thoughts and feelings just like me. This person has at some point been sad, disappointed, angry, hurt, or confused, just like me. And this person has, in their own life, experienced physical and emotional pain and suffering, just like me. And this person wishes to be free from pain and suffering, just like me. And this person wishes to be safe, healthy, and loved, just like me. And this person wishes to be happy, just like me. And now, with that wish for your dear friend to find happiness, allow that visual image to dissolve back into the space of your mind. And now bring to mind someone else. And this time I'll invite you to think of someone that you feel you might have some difference with. It's hard to see them as being just like you. Maybe it's somebody with a different political view. Maybe somebody of a different religious tradition, a different nationality, language, whatever it might be. But whoever you might think of as other, maybe it's someone who's done actions that have really harmed others. Someone for whom you might have either a judgment or just a feeling of really holding them at arm's length, not really wanting to connect, not thinking of them as like you in terms of their experience, their thoughts, their beliefs. I invite you to bring someone like this to mind. Again, a specific person. It can either be someone you know in your life or a public figure. And invite you to imagine them too sitting in front of you, either by way of a visual image or a felt sense of their presence. But let their presence Again, as you did with your dear friend, let that image or that felt sense become real. You might notice it feels really different with this person than it did with your friend. Taking a few moments to build up that visualization, that felt sense. And understanding that this person too, despite their beliefs, the way they live their life, the actions that they do, this person too is a fellow human being, just like me. This person has a body and mind just like me. And this person has sensations, feelings, and thoughts just like me. This person has been sad, disappointed, angry, hurt, confused, experienced both physical and emotional suffering, just like me. And this person too wishes to be free from pain and suffering, just like me. This person wishes to be safe, happy, healthy, and loved, just like me. And if a feeling of connection and shared common humanity has arisen, just rest in that feeling for a moment, even towards this person that's hard to connect with. They also wish to be free of suffering, wish for happiness, just like me. And then letting the visual image of that person dissolve back into the space of your mind. And relaxing your posture and your attention and slowly coming out of meditation and back to the room.
I'll give a brief teaching that builds on that beautiful guided meditation Tenzin just did. The Buddha spoke about the power of practicing in a threefold way. That's to notice our internal experience, our external experience, and how they influence each other. Another way of saying this what he often said was that the definition of a wise person is someone who considers themselves, others, and everyone, just like me. Specifically, it's someone who considers benefit. One way of considering benefit is to also recognize this universality, the just-like-me-ness of discomfort, of suffering, of that beautiful wish to be happy. And while that can be powerful and true, sometimes it's easy to leave out or miss some of the rubs for us or the specifics for us if it's just this blanket statement, right? Hence the value of considering a specific individual. So I'm just going to focus for a moment here on one or two kinds of suffering. The suffering of separation, of loss or lack of status, is one that impacts humans and other primates quite significantly. It can be painful, as or more painful than physical pain, if you look at brain imagery, actually. So to notice internal suffering, the purpose is for the purpose of getting to know it and for the purpose of freedom eventually. And there's a story from my own life. Many of you may have read this in an article that Evie Strauss wrote. As a young kid, I moved from literally Ahala in Tennessee in the Appalachians, where we'd been there when we got there. The new neighbors had been there for 10 years until we got there. And I went from there for a few years with my homemade clothes and my Southern accent to a very preppy, very chic high school in Chicago, suburban Chicago. And boy, did I ever not fit in. Homemade clothes, homemade haircut, everything, right? Just all wrong. So I'm naming this because there's all these different dimensions of the suffering of separation, of not being part of status, of inclusion, of belonging. All of us have some version of that. And it might not be obvious seeing me now that that was part of my history. What it led to, the gift of it for me, was seeing how other kids suffered. It was like a spotlight was on me, to be able to see that. And then maybe you've noticed for yourself, there's that tie-in, like, oh, I've experienced something like that. Now I can empathize. I can feel into the external suffering around me because there's a point of reference. It could be as simple as who hasn't been the last one picked for a sports team at some point in their life in grade school, or the lunch table. You know, those kind of simple, almost universal things. The recognition of external suffering can be built on that. I remember many years later walking down a street in Atlanta with a very good friend of mine, a colleague at my job. And he was this tiny, wispy, sweet African-American man. And as we're walking along one of the big streets there, he told me the story that, oh, you know, it's different walking with you. And I said, how come? And he said, when I walk by myself and people are at a stoplight, I can hear the car doors locking like dominoes as I walk by. And this man was maybe 5'2", not large, not threatening. So to infer the suffering others might experience through any sense of being othered or being left out is one way of considering it. These kinds of suffering can intersect with utterly universal ones too. And I won't go into this, but just to briefly say that disinclusion, loneliness, has been correlated with a shortened lifespan and all kinds of health problems. So I have four different stories I could tell about this, but we want to put you back into groups to talk to each other and to notice for yourself, is there a time where it doesn't have to be about being othered or being left out the way I've described, but is there a time some kind of difficulty you've experienced has opened your heart to someone who's not like you, to noticing their experience, noticing their difficulty? So we want to ask you to explore for yourselves. And we'll put you into this time pairs for about 15 minutes, a little bit less, maybe 14 minutes plus one for the Zoom rooms. And to consider how being attuned to something that's been difficult for you might have helped you or might help you notice when something's being difficult for someone else.
Homework for you guys. And reiterate, if you'd like to organize into small groups, now that you've connected a little bit in discussions, if you'd like to organize in any way to meet together with each other, totally optional between now and the next session for discussion, that's something that might be nice to do. So we've been talking a lot. I should have told you a spoiler alert at the very beginning, but I'll apologize now. Suffering. We've been talking a lot about suffering because it comes first, not because the causation of suffering comes first, but like Dawn said, there's this sort of whole analogy to the idea of the Buddha as the doctor and the Dharma as the medicine. But before we go to the doctor, we need to know that something hurts, right? We need to know that we're unwell before we're even going to seek out the help. And so that's why that understanding of suffering, that realization of suffering, that's why that comes first and is listed as the first noble truth, even though it gives Buddhism a bad reputation. But I always say, if there were just two noble truths, there's suffering and the cause of suffering, okay, bye. This religion would not have lasted 2,600 years. There's a promise in the cessation and the path that sometimes gets overlooked. But we do have to start, as we've seen today, with acknowledging, yeah, the stuck grocery cart situation. Like, we experience that. We just can't quite steer our lives right. And for some of us, the beginning has been extreme, you know, heartbreak and suffering and grief, and someone died. And sometimes it's like, it just never seems to quite work out. Like, what's going on here? And we also would love for you to focus, because part of the path is what brings us happiness also, right? And so what I'd love for you to do, and I do this for homework for a lot of the trainings that I do, and ask people to notice, when do you feel a sense of happiness, however you define that? It might be peace of mind. It might be just a moment of joy. It might be something like a feeling of connection. But if you subjectively feel, between now and the next time, happiness, notice what just happened. What gives rise to happiness? We've looked at what gives rise to suffering. Let's look at what gives rise to happiness. You might want to carry around a little notebook with you. Just do a little log of, like, oh, I feel that feeling. What just happened? And just noticing kind of the through lines for your own life. And it might be different things for different people, but usually there's some themes that emerge. And then we can discuss that a little bit kind of throughout our time together. But just noticing, what is it that gives rise to happiness for you? Clear? Easy. Fun. Even.
Yeah.
And then for anybody who does a gratitude practice, you can use it as raw data for your daily gratitude practice as well.
Great. That's great. So just to riff off of that for a moment, the Buddha and his followers, for all that he talked about suffering and its causes, the path and the end, they were known back in their time as the happy ones. There's actually scriptural evidence that other groups, other societies, other people would look at the Buddha and the monks and nuns and lay followers and comment, wow, they look radiant. They look peaceful. They look happy. So real encouragement, if you can connect with each other, if you want to, there's a couple of names out there. You can gather around that sheet and self-organize if you're here. I think there's already been some Zoom texts flying. Or as Tenzin said, to use a little bit of a journal or notebook.